Again, we were up to Daf Lamed Hamid base. We just about finished the sugya of Gvinas Akum, which ironically belongs with the next Mishnah, because Gvinas Akum is one of those things that you cannot eat, but you're allowed to get Hana'a from, the way we paskin. However, the Rabbi Meir was of the opinion that Gvinas Beisunyaki was in fact not only could it not be eaten, but one was not allowed to get any benefit from it either. And therefore, it wound up in the previous Mishnah. And so now we're just about completed that sugya. We completed the halacha. But now the Gemara wants to close by discussing that one pasuk which Rabbi Yishmael, that Rabbi Yeshua quoted at Rabbi Yishmael when he wanted to distract him. And he went to, finally, after Rabbi Yishmael kept pushing and pushing and pushing, Rabbi Yishmael said, okay, let's change the topic. How do you read this pasuk? L'reach shmonecha tovim shem t'rach shemecha. So the Gemara says as follows. It is on Lamed Hamed Beis. If you look at the Mishnah, it's about 10 lines or so before the Mishnah. It begins with the word darash. So the Gemara says as follows: Darash Rav Nachman Bereder of Chista. My dechsev. What does it mean? L'reach shemonecha tovim. So the lemat talmid literally it means for smelling your oils are good. Lemat talmid chacham dome litzloche shel palyaton. A talmid chacham is like a jar. Palyaton is this very expensive perfume. So a talmid chacham is supposed to be similar to that, I should add.
Smells nice.
So what's the, yes, but Megula, the Gemara says, Recha Nodef. Mechusa ain Recha Nodef. So when the jar is open, so it produces a pleasant fragrance. When the jar is closed, you can't smell anything. Rashi explains, what does that mean? He says that there's a pasuk, and Rashi doesn't say, there's a pasuk in Mishlei, Brachos Larosh Mashbir Umonea Bar Yikavuhu La'om. So blessings to the head of the person who's mashbir. Mashbir in this case means to distribute, but one who withholds the grain so that the people will curse him. So one tradition in the Medrash is this refers to Yosef HaTzadik, and he was brachos lavosh mashbir, he fed the Egyptians. But the alternative understanding is this refers to a talmid chacham. So there are some people who are talmid chachamim, and they learn a lot, and they learn more, and then they learn some more. But basically, they never go and share their knowledge with anybody else. And that's the person who's a moneh bar yikvu la'om. In other words, what good is he because he doesn't share his Torah knowledge? But brachos lavosh mashbir is the person who shares his knowledge with the world. So in that sense, a talmid chacham who doesn't share his knowledge is like a jar of wonderful perfume, but it's sealed. So it's closed, so nobody can smell anything. But when you open up the jar, then it allows the fragrance to escape, and that's what a talmid chacham is, someone who teaches. The Gemara continues, of lo'od, ela devarim shemechusim imenu misgalin lo. Not only that, but this Talmud Chacham, things that were concealed from him become revealed to him. Shenemar alamos ahevucha. Literally, it means alamos, means the young maidens love you. But here is kribe alumos. Those things which are concealed from you. So what is this referred to? So here you have Machlokas, Rashi, and Tosus, and fundamentally it could be that both are correct. Rashi says, and this I can speak to from sort of personal experience many, many times over in life. Rashi says that misgalano me atzman below Torah kishum alandam. When you teach things, when you have to teach a subject, there are things that are revealed to you that you never understood until you had to teach it. And in fact, I find as a teacher that no matter how much I prepare, there are times I step into shir, and as I'm actually transmitting information, things that either weren't clear in my head or I had trouble understanding as I begin to talk, all of a sudden, either I start to see the questions, that's a problem when you don't have the answers, or I start to all of a sudden realize the direction things that are going in. So a person who wants to understand better has to teach, that's what Al-Kain Alamos Ayvucha. Tosus has a different perspective, which I think is also true, which I think people who are in the pastoral aspects of the rabbinate can certainly speak to. Tosa says that when a person starts to teach Torah, so then people, will approach that person and start to reveal them their secrets, start to confide, and start to start to seek counsel in them, because they see that the person is wise when they speak. So that's what Tosa says. Devarim amechusim la menu miskalna. The second Tosa says, perish b'nei adam megalim lo razehem. People reveal their secrets. Lefi shenen and mimenu eitzev asushia, because they get benefit from the Talmud Chacham providing counsel. I think it goes without saying, as one of my rabbeim once said to me, as he was observing about no specific individual on our faculty, but he made a general comment that he said, not all Rosh Yeshiva are Bali Eitza, but not all of them know it. And unfortunately, some of them, Bishogeg, are violate Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshel. They put a stumbling block in front of the blind. However, there are Talmidei Chachamim, Rabbanim of all stripes, and people also, who when they speak wisely, and people eventually turn to them for counsel. So that's the interpretation that Tosos offers here. There is an assumption, I think we've said this before, which is not always true, is that people of Talmidei Chachamim are also wise and are also Yirei Shamayim. Rav Shecht always likes to quote Rav Nissen Alper, Zichrono Livracha, said, we don't have a barometer for Yirei Shamayim. So we assume that the more Torah a person knows, the greater Yirei Shamayim that they are, which is sometimes true, but unfortunately it's not always true. It's only a barometer, but sometimes you can tell that the barometer is off. So here that's what the person who starts to teach Torah, starts to show his wisdom, so he will either increase his knowledge, his own understanding, or he will help, he will provide counsel to others. And then the Gemara continues, V'lo od el shamalach hamavas oavo, shenemar alamos ahivucha. So the malach hamavas also becomes his friend. How do they get that? Alamos ahivucha kribe al-mavas. This is a very interesting comment the Gemara has. Rashi here doesn't even say anything. And I'm not really sure. I have some thoughts on what this might mean, but the idea that, it's a very, I don't know if you call it, not quite a simile, a personification of the Malach HaMavis. The Malach HaMavis is now the friend of this fellow. I suspect what the Gemara is driving at is a notion that a Talmud Chacham who teaches Torah and acquires wisdom in that fashion has a different perspective on life, and has a different relationship in that sense with death. That's what I think it means, that the Malach HaMavis loves him. But I'll sort of leave it at that kernel of a thought. I'm not going to develop that further for now. And finally, the last thing the Gemara says, V'lo od el shenochal shnei olamos. He inherits two worlds, echar olam hazeh ve'echar olam haba, shenemar alamos kribe olamos. Now, of course, this is a double play on language, because not only, obviously, the word alamos means something else, but this is also an interplay between the biblical Hebrew meaning of the word and the rabbinic Hebrew meaning of the word. The word olam, which today, I think the popular song, if you ask for one popular usage of the word that comes to mind today, is probably kola olam kulo gesher tzam od. So the word olam there means world. It refers to really a place. Or in Chazal, in the expression of why Kadosh Baruch was called Hamakom, is that Hu Mekomo Sha'olam Ha'ina Olam Mekomo. However, when you actually study biblical Hebrew, the word Olam, perhaps with one exception, maybe in Sefer Koheles, Gamas Ha'olam Nasan Belibam, with that exception, the word Olam never refers, is never used spatially, it's always used temporally. Olam means for eternity. So here, the Gemara has really gone through two steps, one which is not even stated, which is to read the word alamos as olamos, and then to come with the second jump that olamos refers to, two spheres, olam hazeh and olam haba, although I guess that could also be two time spheres. Okay. Fine, the end of the Agada. And now, to the second of the three groups of Mishnahs in the second half of this parak. The first Mishnah, as we said earlier, dealt with Isurei Hana'ah, not only things that you couldn't eat, but things that you couldn't get any benefit from. This Mishnah is going to deal with things that you're not allowed to eat, but you are allowed to get benefit from. And then there's a third Mishnah towards the end of the parak, the things that you're even permitted to eat. So the Mishnah says as follows, Ve'elu dvarim shel ovdei kochavim asurin, these things are prohibited, but there is no prohibition in getting benefit from it. The first one is chalav shechalavo ovdei kochavim ve'en yisrael ro'ehu. This is milk that a non-Jew milked from an animal, and a Jew wasn't watching. So, God willing, those who were here 2 weeks ago, So we spoke about, we started the first year on halachic change. So in a couple of weeks, on Memorial Day weekend, we're going to have the second one. And one of the issues we will talk about then is Ramosha's tshuva about chalav stam as opposed to chalav akum. But the Mishnah says, straightforward, that if you have milk that is produced by a non-Jew, so then, and a Jew doesn't watch the process, so there's no way to know whether it was kosher milk or non-kosher milk, and therefore the milk is prohibited. V'hapas v'hashemen shalahem. So the bread of a non-Jew and the oil of a non-Jew. Now, both of these are going to provoke a lot of interesting discussion, both in the Gemara and in the Mishonim. What's interesting about both of these two cases is that we observe certainly not shemen and probably not pas either. Aaron is not here today, but if I were to mention, he would be kvetching about the claims of certain kashrus organizations that the olive oil has been adulterated and you can't trust it. So regardless of those particular the claims or whether that is a true concern or a concern that somebody has invented, nonetheless, it is clear that in situations where there's no concern of adulteration, so olive oil is permitted. And the question is why? It's shemen shel goyim. So it's clear the Gemara is going to talk about it. The gzeira on shemen is no longer in force, hasn't been in force in a very long time. Pas is the more interesting one. Pas is interesting because you know you can go into the supermarket and you can buy, let's say, Freihofer's bread. Now, I know that Freihofer sounds like a Jewish name. Arnold's not so much. But nonetheless, it's probably not, I don't know if they're Jews at any particular point. This is pas akum. This is the bread of non-Jews. And nonetheless, the OU puts its symbol on it. So the question is, why is that the case? So the Gemara, that hopefully we'll get to today already, starts to deal with that particular issue. The Mishnah now now the other interesting thing, which we're not going to talk about today, is but what does it mean pas akum? And here there actually is a major machlokas harishonim, which we will explore at some point at greater length. The Ran actually quotes it on the Mishnah here because he's not the only one, but he has a somewhat unique opinion. We tend to think pas simply refers to bread. Well, how do you make bread? Well, you make a dough, you knead it, you arrange it, shape it however you want, you stick it in the oven. The Gemara has certain leniencies by pas akum, which is that if the Jew does some of the things, so that renders it permissible. Some of you may know from if you've ever encountered the discussion of bishul akum, that we seem to have adopted some of those leniencies by bishul akum, Ashkenazim in particular. The idea that if the Jew turns on the fire and walks away, it's not a problem with bishul akum. But it really starts in the dinim of pas akum. So the question is, what would happen if a non-Jew produced a dough, but a Jew went ahead and baked it? Is that called pas akum or not? So we generally assume that the discussion of pas akum refers to the same stage as bishul akum. And bishul akum doesn't refer to cutting up the vegetables, cutting up the meat. It actually refers to the cooking. That's what we usually assume. There is an opinion in Rishonim, however, that that's not true. That, in fact, the baking of the bread itself constitutes a problem of bishul akum. And when the Gemara, and pas akum has nothing to do with the baking of the bread. Pas akum has to do with the lisha, with the kneading of the bread, with the mixing of the water and the flour, with the aricha, with the shaping. And that if a goy were to produce dough, for example, you can go into the supermarket and you can buy pizza dough. So we generally assume that no matter who made that pizza dough, it could have been your next door neighbor, if the pizza dough, assuming you know the ingredients are kosher, so you can take it home and you can bake it in the oven. Yet there are Rishonim who claim that no, that once the process of the dough essentially has been completed, so then that's called pas akum. So when you talk about the leniencies, if the Jew bakes it, if the Jew stokes the coals once or something like that, that all deals with bishul akum. And that once you have a dough that's been made already, we're no longer in the sugya of bishul akum and pas akum. We're now in the sugya of bishul akum. So we're going to come back and talk about that. That's not the way we assume. We assume that the goy could make it from start to finish, and under certain circumstances, we permit it because we're not so concerned about pas akum. We'll talk about which part of pas akum. And bishul akum refers to anything that is cooked except for things that qualify as bread. That's the best way of putting it. Okay, so we'll come back and talk about that more. But now the Mishnah has a line that you should erase from your Mishnah. I don't mean literally, but it's not actually part of the Mishnah. Rebbe u'beis dino hitur hashemen. Now, literally it means Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and his Beis Din permitted Shemen. So even though Shemen had once upon a time been Osir, but Ein Isura Israna, so Rabbi and his Beis Din permitted Shemen Shalakum. In the Gemara, it becomes clear that the matir for Shemen Shalakim was not Rebbe, Ubeistina, Rebbe being Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, it was Rebbe Yehuda Nisia. Rebbe Yehuda Nisia was Rebbe Yehuda Nasi's grandson. Even though it's very clear, we know that Rebbe did not actually finish the Mishnah, because there are statements of Rebbe in the Mishnah, so obviously by definition, in all likelihood, he didn't finish it. Nonetheless, Rebbe Yehuda Nisia is already two generations later, and it's generally assumed, some of us know, that there are later things that have crept into the Mishnah. It's not part of the original Mishnah that left the base medrash of Rebbe. So we'll take that line out for the moment, but it does give us a sense of the coming attractions. Then, Vehashlakos. Now, I'm going to put the comma here, as does both the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, although one could have raised the question whether it has to be read this way. Shlakos referred literally to vegetables, things that have been cooked. This is what's classically known as Bishul Akum. It's not limited to vegetables, as we'll see. It's limited to pretty much anything. It includes pretty much anything that you cook, subject to certain conditions. Then the Mishnah continues, Ukvashim Shedarka Loses Lesochan Yayin Vichometz. The kvashim are vegetables that are pickled. Now you pickle things in salt water, that shouldn't be a problem. However, sometimes you have not only salt water, but they had either wine might have been placed in, or, which we still will have, vinegar. And once you introduce the question of vinegar, so now immediately the question becomes, what was the likely source of vinegar? And probably the most likely source for them of vinegar was going to be wine. So basically what it means, we have pickled stuff that it is typical to place wine or a wine derivative in. Now, theoretically, but nobody does read it this way, not as far as I can tell, none of the Rishonim, I think it's clear the Bavli and the Yerushalmi don't read it this way. I was just reading the Mishnah, and I was wondering whether you could have read, V'hashlakos ukvashim shedarkan losis lesochan yayin v'chometz. That it doesn't, in other words, don't put the comma after shlakos. It would mean vegetables that are cooked or vegetables that are pickled when you typically use vinegar or wine in the cooking. Clearly, the radical idea that emerges from that reading is that there would be no such isser as bishalakum. Clearly, neither the Bavli nor Yerushalmi read it that way. I suspect the reason for that is that while it is likely to put wine, I mean, you may as well cook with vinegar. I doubt. Maybe it's just as likely, I don't know, maybe to put chometz in the shlakos as well. So apparently they had a tradition. If there's no compelling reason otherwise, they must have had a tradition that you read v'hashlakos, semicolon, and then, in other words, that means any bishalakum. It doesn't have to be something you're concerned about tarfus. And then vegetables that are pickled, where you typically use wine or vinegar in the pickling. Okay.
What's the source of bishalakum?
This is it, shlakos.
So
let me step back. The Gemara is going to talk about each of these things. What is the reason behind it? Chalav is the only one of this list until now. Well, I said chalav and kvashim are a concern over mixing of non-kosher ingredients. Okay, the Gemara will talk about what the concern with chalav is, and it's the Mishnah says kvashim because you might put non-kosher, you put wine or vinegar in it. Pas, shemen, and shlakos are all understood to be midin chasnos, a concern of intermarriage. Which is why we're going to see that the leniency that we have, shemen is completely mutter, whereas pas, the way we paskin, is mutter only when it is pas palter. Palter means commercial, a baker, as opposed to pas shabalabatim. And the reason for that being that commercially produced things, it doesn't create the same kind of a social connection as that which was baked in someone's home oven.
Is that the same as non-kosher wine?
It's the same. Wine had two reasons. The original reason had to do with avodah zarah actually being used in ritual context. But the second reason behind what we call stam yinam is chastos, is the concern of intermarriage. Correct.
But Rabbi, this sort of raises, especially for our community, very interesting fundamental principle of our community dilemma, which is, here we are encouraging our kids to go off to college, to have, not necessarily Orthodox Jewish roommates, and to see the world and experience the world. And one of the pitfalls of that, encouragement might be that they befriend people who will lead them astray. And so if this if this doctrine of mipi chasanos is something that is not just guidance but implemented in halakha, then maybe modern Orthodox communities need to reevaluate, you know, its core, their core principles.
I'm not going to argue with that.
I think that is
a real issue. I think that you deal with your, and I think you identify correctly. There are the technical aspects, and I've highlighted the somewhat comic nature of this, which is, you know, Yain Mavusha. I told that story about our friends, you know, where he was a smicha student, he was a Baal Tshuva. His brother wasn't from, was dating a non-Jewish woman. They invited them over for Seder, and so our friends had to make sure that all the Yain was Mavushal. Right, so you're sitting here thinking, okay, well, let's get the Yayim Vushal, right? Why? Because why were Yayim Vushal? Because of Chasnus, right? And here you are sitting with your, it's not his fault, your brother has brought his non-Jewish girlfriend to the Seder. I think it really is an issue. I think as a community, it's true for a whole host of issues. If you only have one pole, you know, to which you gravitate, it's very easy. In that sense, at least ideologically, being Haredi is very simple. Right, because there's really only fundamentally one set of values, and your interaction with the broader world is only because you have to, right? Because you have to earn a parnasa, because you need to have this, you need to have that. Those of us who value, and those who would be secular, for whom Torah wouldn't mean very much, even if they have some type of a connection. So for them, the calculus is very simple as well. I think the modern Orthodox community does face this struggle, and different people do take different approaches. I think it is unfortunate when people don't acknowledge what the pitfalls are. In other words, it's one thing to say, I have made a calculation that, you know, These are sort of our communal norms and values. These are Torah values. There are things that I feel I can only get in context A, B, C, or D. And now I have to decide sort of what is the trade-offs, and, you know, what are the risks of each side? There are risks to insularity. One thing I can say is most likely, even though obviously my choices are make clear where my sympathies lie in this particular issue of college, one of the things that it's much more likely in the context of secular college campus life is that you don't get certain kinds of racism and certain kinds of pejorative attitudes towards non-Jews and people who are different. And that is at least one positive thing, because when you're in contact with people, you know, of different sorts, then you realize that they're human just like you are. The downsides are as you describe, and I think that's that is a tricky calculus. You know, some have complained. Interestingly enough, some have complained. About the OU when they not only have JLIC on campus, but they sort of tout it that it's a little bit of, I don't say mekach tos, but you're sort of minimizing what the dangers are. In other words, saying that I have, you know, there's a JLIC couple there, and I've met many of them, and they are really many of them, are outstanding and wonderful, but you're not fully acknowledging what the pitfalls are of being in a certain kind of environment, because most people, and it's one of the most beautiful drushes that I've heard, Dr. Lamb quoted this, a Yalkut Ruveni, that said that the world stands on the Nunum Hafuchim. The Nunum Hafuchim mean the upside down Nuns in Parshas Balosos. So Dr. Lamb said, what's a Nun Hafuch? So he said that Nun in Aramaic is a fish. Nuna is a fish. And a Nun Hafuch is a fish that swims against the stream. Right? That's what makes the world, that's what moves the world forward. But the reality is, for most of us, virtually all of us, we don't do well swimming against the stream. And it is certainly true for adolescents, so it's a huge, huge challenge. So I think you're correct, and I think everybody has to make that decision of, you know, weighing the two and deciding, you know, what you know. And the truth is, every individual is different. Also, you have to know your customer. But I think it is a real challenge, and it's a real issue. And I think probably as a community, we dance around the issue a little bit too much. I think that people can make different decisions, but I think people should be honest about what the decisions are. So yes, I think this speaks to a larger ethos of that concern.
Doesn't end on the college level, though, right?
What's that?
It doesn't end on the college level. It's education and work.
Correct. The work is the same issue. The difference, I think, is that once people get married, then the pull of gravity towards family and community provides a much greater buffer. But not that it's not a concern. People, you know, again, There was a book I've just started rereading, and I think I quoted it in my first Shabbos Haggadah Drasha, called Blind Spots. It's about ethics and why many ethical failings come about. And the argument of the authors is that most ethical failings are not because people deliberately violated. If people deliberately violate things that you know are unethical, you can have all the ethical training in law school or in business school. None of it helps, because when people know something is dishonest, they're either honest people or dishonest people. The real danger are what they call the blind spots, what they call bounded ethicality, where you can't see. Where you don't realize it's a conflict of interest. And the point of the authors is that the key towards preventing ethical violations is to teach people to be aware of their blind spots. In other words, understand the choices that you're making, that what you're facing. When you don't see it, that's when the greatest danger is. So I think that as a community, those are issues that are important. I think we have to see, we have to be aware of what the real dangers are. And then everybody has to make their own choice in that regard. That is one of the other aspects that defines our community different than the Haredi world, is autonomy. We place a much greater value on autonomy, so everybody is going to, you know, within certain bounds, is going to make their own decisions of what they see best for themselves or their children. Okay, so the Mishnah, those middle three are Mishum Chasnus, and the first and last are a concern of non-kosher food being mixed in. Now the Mishnah continues, and this particularly strikes home. There was a discussion on the RCA list, and Aaron would appreciate if he were here, because he would appreciate my cynicism. There was discussion of fish bought from Costco, salmon bought from Costco. So full disclosure here, I buy salmon on a weekly basis from Costco, so maybe I'm no gay with that because I've already decided this issue. And apparently the OU says...
Don't they have an OU version? They
do sometimes, yes, and it's more expensive. And although someone said now the OU is not, that there isn't a version. The only two versions that exist are those raised with and without antibiotics. Okay. So I do the Costco shopping, so I buy the salmon virtually every week. And the OU has said, even though I wonder about this, that the color of the salmon itself is enough of a simon. Normally, all you would need is to have fins and scales, scales left on the fish a little bit, and this way you have a simon. You could buy any fish that way if the scales are still attached. If you can see it, then you know it's a kosher fish. So their argument is the color is enough, the color of salmon is unique, which is interesting because the color of the farm-raised salmon is not a natural coloring. It's an artificial coloring, because the natural coloring, I think, actually comes from the shrimp or other kinds of sea creatures that wild salmon eat. Now, if you happen to go into Costco, I do wonder about the basis for this, because there's another fish there that has the same coloring, which also must be a product of the coloring, is the steelhead trout. But that happens to be kosher fish as well. So it probably is the case in reality that nothing looks the color of salmon except for things that happen to be kosher fish. Someone posted on the list, you know, so a lot of people were discussing and said, someone who works in the field of kosher has posted on the list and said, but what do you have to know that in the factories that they, you know, when they're cutting the fish, that, you know, that they're not using knives that we use for other fish. So all I want to say on this is that, and it's clear from so many things we've seen, we're not machzik in isser. I'm willing to bet a lot of money that when they cut the salmon, not only they probably, if they don't have their own one knife in different knives and people working in different areas, I'm almost certain they wash the knife between cutting the fish, probably between cutting one fish and the next, so as to not cross-contaminate potentially one salmon with another salmon. You go into the supermarket, the Pathmark, Alava Shalom and Tina, Pathmark, and you'd go to the fish counter, and every time they cut fish, you see them rinse the knife off in a strong stream of water. So I can't tell you that it's impossible, but if you accept the principle that the salmon is distinctive looking, one does not have to be machzik and isser of there being, maybe he used the treif knife. So here, the Mishnah, I mentioned that as a precursor, because I won't paskin for the community. I'll leave that for Rabbi Lookstein or Rabbi Steinmetz. But personally, I'm a no gay whatever. I do purchase and eat the salmon as well. Yes.
We worry that it's mislabeled.
Correct. You just worry that it's not a kosher fish. It can be mislabeled, as long as it's mislabeling is for another kosher fish. The concern is, how do you know? In other words,
we can't trust the label.
So fish requires either one or two seals ordinarily, because we're afraid of being machlif. So the answer is yeah. Now, this fish doesn't have a cheskas kashrus, the way in principle vegetables or grain, those non-animal products, as a general rule, unless they're included in the Mishnah, like yayin or something like that, have a cheskas kashrus. And in order to be concerned, you have to know that there really is a concern. But balei chayim don't start out with that cheskas kashrus. So that's why meat, in other words, why does... We did this sugya already. We did the seal sugya, right? I think we did it a while ago. But things that don't start out with a cheskas kashrus, so then you require some type of proof to it. And a goy does not have ne'amonus. Even though, I mean, I want to say that I have little reason to doubt what they're putting out there. Although sometimes people say there's a lot of mislabeling of stuff. Some of it's unintentional, and sometimes
they're labeling it. In the store they're actually labeling.
I think so. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
It's not like it.
And look, even if it came from a central location, where is the ne'amonus there? So, I suspect that there is a lot of mislabeling accidentally, and maybe even intentionally. I suspect that I wouldn't trust a lot of Jews any more than I would non-Jews. I don't inherently distrust non-Jews, even though halacha does draw a distinction between the two. So the only basis, the basis for being allowed to purchase fish would be if it has scales on it. There are a lot of people in the community. I don't think it's proper. I don't think the minhag has changed in Teaneck. I know that aren't so careful. There are a couple of fish stores in Teaneck. There's the kosher fish store and there's the non-kosher fish store. And I think the non-kosher fish store, I'm told by my wife, is the fish is better. I don't know if it's necessarily less expensive. It is better quality stuff. But they're always annoyed when she goes in there because she asks. She'll only buy it if she's buying tuna. You know, for yentav or something, she'll only buy it if she can find, ask that the little bit on. And they're annoyed by it. Now, the fact they're annoyed by it tells us that most of the modern Orthodox Balabatim Teaneck are not asking them to do it, because otherwise it would be de rigueur for them, and they wouldn't, it's probably only a few annoying Balabatim are asking it. So I'm not sure on what basis people do that. Do I think that they're mislabeling stuff or much? Probably not. But salmon is in a different category because it, in fact, is distinctive. Which really is the underlying principle about what's about to be discussed in this Mishnah and the Mishnah, the parallel Mishnah later. The Mishnah is going to prohibit one type of fish. The Mishnah later permits a certain kind of fish because there's a chazaka. In one case, there's a chazaka, it's kosher. In the other case, we're not sure because there could be stuff mixed in. So now the Mishnah says as follows. Vitaris trufa. Taris trufa, Rashi says, is small salted fish, I call it like herring, that's been chopped up and you can't recognize the fish. So in this case, you don't know, there might have been non-kosher fish mixed in as well. As opposed to taris she'eno trufa, which will be permissible because you can see the fish and you can see if they're kosher fish or not. Then, vitzir she'en ba daga kilbis shotetas. If you have fish brine, which doesn't have, it would have this little fish swimming in it called the kilbis. So Rashi says that this fish, this kilbis fish, cannot survive in non-kosher fish brine. And therefore, if you see the kilbis swimming in it, you know that all the brine is from a kosher fish. If, however, you don't see the kilbis swimming in it, then it's possible that they have mixed in various kinds of fish brine, and therefore you can't purchase it. It's asur ba'achila. That's the way Rashi understands. The Ran has a very different understanding. Ritva has a very different understanding of what it means, daga kilbis shotetesbo, of what that's about. And I think he says that it was like an advertising sign or something like that, which is interesting. That that he'd stick some of these fish in if it were a certain kind of seer. Then, v'hachilak. What is chilak? So Rashi says that these are very, very small fish, and they're fish that don't have fins and scales, or don't have scales, really, when they're very little. Now, the halacha is that if you have a fish that doesn't have scales now, but will eventually grow it, the fish is kosher. But the problem is, if these fish are very small, and most people cannot identify them, and therefore, there might be some of the little fish in it are, in fact, fish that are not kosher, and only some are kosher, and therefore, one is not allowed to purchase chilak. I think they say that we encountered a chilak shel uman might be permissible of a professional person, merchant whose trade it is, and he perhaps is not going to undermine his nemanus. But the Mishnah speaks about here regular chilak. This may be chilak shel balabatim. And now, what might be the bane of Rabbi's existence of Yeridei Shailas comes the most annoying part is the koret shel chiltas. What is a koret shel chiltas? So, before I tell you what a koret shel chiltas is, I'll tell you what emerges from this for those who deal with kitchen shilas. Normally, if a person, a balabas or balabasta, calls the rabbi and says, I accidentally cooked something let's say, you don't usually get a treif pot, but let's say I cooked something in a milchuk pot or in a fleishuk pot. And what do I do with the food? So ordinarily speaking, the first question you ask is, when was the last time you used the pot before doing that? And if the pot was clean, it wasn't used in 24 hours, so we say it's an eino ben yomo, the pot might be treif, but the food is kosher. However, there's one other question that has to be asked, or this could be asked generally. Let's say you're in a situation where you're purchasing food that a non-Jew might have made. The food, everything is kosher in it, but he might have used non-kosher kelim. And the question is this, were the kelim likely to have been used in 24 hours? And if the answer is no, it should be permitted. Except, there's one catch. You have to know what the food being cooked was. Because if the food, the rabbi might say, was the food something like onions or garlic, something that was very sharp, a davar charet. And if it is, that sort of changes the game. All of a sudden, the rules change. And now the assumption is that even though the pot was more than 24 hours old, that the pugum flavor that was in the pot, when it enters sharp food, the sharp food has the effect of making it actually palatable, making it l'shvach, and therefore it's a problem even if it wasn't used in 24 hours. We're not going to discuss that entire sugya now, but it is based upon this part of the Mishnah. The koret shel chiltis. What is koret? Is just a, I almost said like it's a carrot, not the vegetable, but like a little thing, like a clump of, it's called a koret. It's like a piece of a root or something like that. It's a nodule. And chiltis, okay, is a vegetable, not a vegetable root called asafoetida. Okay, I don't know how many of you have heard of that. I had to pull out my Sansino and to figure out what was chiltis. I know I could tell you all the dinim of koret shel chiltis, but until yesterday I never actually knew what chiltis was. Which just tells you something about how we teach Yoredeya. You know, certain things are just abstract. I taught Yoredeya, I think, already two or three times, and it's just kind of abstract. You know, sharp things. So asafoetida is actually a root. I don't know exactly what, I've never seen it, but it is a resin. It is a very sticky type of thing that comes out of some root. That's the word asa, I think, in Persian. And foetida is related to it's Latin, related to the English word fetid, which means having a terrible smell. So it's this like gummy resin-like substance which has an awful smell. It can be used in cooking. Apparently when you cook with it, it actually adds a positive flavor. And it was also used as something to reduce intestinal gas. Was used in many types of medicines. If you look at the Wikipedia entry, which I only looked at this morning on it, there are apparently lots of medicinal uses that, again, I didn't have the chance to look at each one and see what the sources were, that might actually have real value. Anyway, chiltis apparently is very, very sharp. Now, what is the concern with koret shel chiltis? So Rashi explains Rashi, the second to last Dibur Maschil in the Mishnah Chiltis, says, Min perehu shekoren lazra belaz, okay, umechatchin es kratav bisakin. You cut the root with a knife. V'asur mishum shamnunisa disakina. It's prohibited because of the shamnunis on the knife. It means that the guy is taking a knife that he used with tray food, he has chazur shmaltz on this knife, and now he cuts the koret shel chiltis. And therefore, the chiltis is going to absorb from the shamnunis. Now, if everybody held like Rashi, incidentally, we wouldn't have to worry about davar charif, right? The concern has nothing to do, it would not be applicable in most cases, because the only reason it's a concern is because the knife has stuff on it. Today, typically, you know, one of the more common cases this comes up is somebody chopped an onion for the cholent, and they used a milchik knife. Now, if Rashi's pshat is correct, there's not even a shaila, because the knife that you used to cut the onion with was clean. The chumras that we have that really emerge, one of the major chumras, it's not there's another piece of davar charif that's not from this, but one of the chumras that emerges is that when you cut something with a knife, and it's a sharp food, even though the knife was clean and hasn't been used for 24 hours, number one, even though there's no heat, what's called duchaka de sakina, the force of the knife, causes blios to come out of the knife. You don't need heat. And those blios are, even after 24 hours, no Saint Tam l'shvach. They flavor positively. And that's why, in this case, the onion can become milchik from the knife. Okay? If you adopted Rashi's approach, you might still have to deal with davar charif when you cook with heat, but you would never have to worry about knives. So the combination of knives and davar charif is the rabbi's or the Balabatim's nightmare. But that only emerges if you assume that the concern with cutting with the knife is a clean knife with the blios inside, not like Rashi and many other Mishanim who say that it's actually the stuff that was left on the knife, because they couldn't clean knives well. Right? In fact, how do you kosher a knife? What's the old Jewish wives' way of making kosher a knife? You plant it, stick it in a flower pot. So if you want to understand, so that's an error. It's actually the last Gemara in our Masechta. We have a while to get there. God willing, we'll get there. So the where does that come from? The Gemara says that if you had a knife, and the concern was you actually had treif stuff on a knife. You can't kasher a knife that's balua of iser, that's been used on the heat this way. But if you had a knife that had stuff on the outside, the way to clean it off is you take the knife, and you go to hard ground, not a soft flower pot, really hard ground where you got to push it in, you stick it in, and you pull it out. And you do that repeatedly, and what that does is it cleans the knife off, right? And people who didn't have cleansers, didn't have, emulsifiers and things like that, it's not easy to get a knife clean. That's the way you did it. You stuck in noatzo bekarka kasha asara pama. It may actually have to be 10 times.
About having the separate knives for the vachara?
What's that?
Having separate set of knives.
Well, and that will solve a certain kind of problem. If you have par of knives and you use that at davar charev, that will work, right? But so that's what you normally do. You take your knife that is par of, that's what you chop the onion with. But sometimes somebody forgot and they took a milchuk onion, and now if you're lucky they didn't toss it into the cholent. If you're unlucky they did, and now you have to figure out how to deal with the bittul issue. Yes. Okay, so that is what Koret Shel Chiltis, this is one of the major pieces of the davar charev issue, comes from this, the Koret Shel Chiltis. Finally, Umelach Shal Kunadis. The Gemara will talk about what the concern is. It has to do with they used to mix stuff into the salt, this type of salt. Hare Elu Asurin Ve'eni Surin Isra'na. So the Mishnah repeats the rule that these things are Asur, but their prohibition is not one of Hana. You're only not allowed to eat it. Now, I don't know what the Gemara will say about this, but just as a way, as a traditional, a standard way that the Talmud Bavli interprets Mishnayos, this last line is superfluous. From a literary perspective, it's very nice. You have opening and closing with the same statement, but it's superfluous, and therefore, the Bavli is going to assume that there's something else that the Mishnah didn't list that's included. Just like when they darshan psukim, when you have an extra word in the pasuk, an extra letter, they assume it's teaching you something in addition. So too, the way they treat the Mishnah is that there's an extra line here. It is superfluous on some level, and therefore, we're going to tell you that we're going to learn something, I suspect, in addition from this last line. But we'll get there eventually. Okay, so now, yes.
Just going back to last week, 2 weeks ago, discussion about when the reason falls away.
Yes.
Right? I mean, I assume scientifically we can prove it today, whether there is any flavoring that changes.
Yes, so we could do better than that. At Machon Lev, they've done experiments with stainless steel to demonstrate that stainless steel is bolea even less than glass. Now, yes. So the catches were, if you asked me, I will, even though I'm speaking on tape, so I would never paskin this way as a rule. But if you're asking me, I'll pidin. The answer is that stainless steel then should be treated like glass. And if Sfardim, for example, Ashkenazim, I've never heard of Ashkenazim using glass for both milchiks and fleishiks. There's a contradiction in the Ramah as to whether or not glass is bolea, is not bolea. So there are different how do you resolve the contradiction? There are many, self-included, but I'm not the author of this shita, who distinguish between Pesach and year-round. In other words, year-round we assume glass does not absorb, but Pesach, you can't kasher glass for it. In other words, it absorbs the chametz, and you can't kasher it. But nonetheless, I don't know of Ashkenazim, at least, who used karel dishes of both milchiks and fleishiks, even though apidin, according to the way we hold, you should be able to. Drinking glasses, many of us will use of both, but they're not used really with heat. And the truth is, even the karel plates are not used in the cooking. But nonetheless, I don't get the sense that, part of it because it's not that expensive, and that the Ashkenazim don't do it. But apidin, it would be mutter. And, if stainless steel, in fact, is balea no more or less than glass, I mean, very, very tiny amounts, then, in fact, it should be permissible as well. You should only need one set of stainless steel pots. Now, it's not true for all pots. Cast iron pots are designed on a certain level that they absorb. That's why you have to season them. But stainless steel should not become treif, if it's clean, you should not require separate milchiks or fleishiks. So the same thing holds true as well here. I know darn well when I have my knife, my milchik knife. So one of the questions I always ask people when they get the shaila is, how was your knife really milchik? Right, because that's an important question. Because if all you used the knife was to cut cheese, you know, when you took it out of the fridge or even if you left it on the counter a while, it's not really a milchik knife. So that's one way of solving the problem. It would have to be a knife that you used, that you were cutting things when they were in the process of cooking, in order to get, you know, again, same thing is true for most fleishik knives. Really, I mean, there's more to talk about in this context, but really, I'll be then, your steak knives and your regular knives, you never use them with something that's hot enough to create really such a problem. So if you use a knife on the grill or something like that, or the fork on the grill, so that might be an issue. But we don't have so many of those things. So, but yes, the answer is really alpidin. If we were to determine factually, then I think that we would adopt a particular position. Yeah. Okay. So now, the Gemara talks about milk. The Gemara says as follows. Chalav l'may nechashla. What are you concerned? What are you concerned? I'm sorry? What's that?
No, just what are you worried about?
Yes, what's the concern? If you're talking about him swapping, meaning he's going to swap, give you non-kosher animals' milk in lieu of kosher animals' milk. So the Gemara says, they don't look alike. Tahor is chivar. Kosher milk looks white. Tameh yarok is not green, but probably yellowish. So I don't know, but I assume that that was in fact, I assume that's true at least for the animals that they were looking at, because they could see with their own eyes. If you're concerned that the guy is going to mix in non-kosher milk, blend some non-kosher milk into the milk, nikum, make it into cheese. Why? The amarmer chalav chalev tahar omed, chalev tameh ena omed. You cannot turn non-kosher milk into cheese. It's not omed. It doesn't curdle. The Ritva writes here, it doesn't mean it doesn't curdle, but it doesn't curdle the same way as kosher milk. As kosher animals' milk does. And that, I think, we had this discussion a couple times ago, and that seemed to have been at least established, somebody looking online, that it doesn't quite curdle the same way. So, very simple test. Just take the milk and make it into cheese, and that won't be a problem. So the Gemara says, Ida kaboy legvina, if you want the milk, buy the milk. For the purposes of making cheese, then hachinami, you're right. Then it's simple, you don't have a problem. Just turn it into cheese, and then if it turns into cheese properly, then it's not a problem of chalev akum. However, hacha b'maya skin, and the kaboy le kamcha. Kamcha is, Rashi says, machal. I thought kamcha was actually something like that, like a sour dip or something like that. And therefore, you're not going to curdle the cheese. You're going to have the milk, you know, stay as it is. And therefore, you're not going to be able to test it. So the Gemara says, so what? Vinishko mine kli vinekum. Just take a little bit and test it. Turn it into cheese. And if it doesn't turn into cheese, you know you've got a problem. If it turns into cheese, enjoy. So the Gemara says, Kevan de bitahar, no. Nami ika nisyuve de lo kaimi, lekam lamekam ala de milsa. Now, you know why? You can't tell for sure by turning a little amount into cheese, because even when you turn milk into cheese, there is stuff, I suppose it's the whey, some of it does not actually curdle. And the concern is that the treif milk will remain uncurdled, mixed with the kosher non-curdled parts of the milk, and therefore you won't be able to tell. Now, once you say that, of course, and I'm going to change the gears in the Gemara here to read like the Rif, not the e bois ema, but rather, rather on the last word on the line, but rather hashta the asas lahachi. Once you've established that turning a little bit into cheese will not prove to you whether or not there was no kosher milk, prove to you that there was no kosher milk, non-kosher milk mixed in, then hashta the asas lahachi afilu teme the kabay lelgvina ikatkoi bene atve. So it doesn't matter if you want to use the whole thing for making cheese. The problem is that when you make the cheese, there are little parts of it and pockets of it that don't actually curdle. And those, I presume, I don't know, I've never been involved in the making of cheese, the cheesemakers remove that stuff, but the problem is some of it you can't get out, and therefore you may have treif milk mixed into those little pockets, and that is the concern of chalav akum. We're afraid that he mixes it in. Now, if this is true, so one question that should come to mind, it didn't come to my mind, but it did come to Tosfos' mind, which is, why then does the Gemara have a whole discussion about gevinas akum? Why don't you just say the reason why you can't have gevinas akum is because the chalav is chalav akum? And that should be the end of the issue, right? How did the guy get... the guy bought the milk from the Jew and then made the cheese. I mean, I suppose that's possible. So, Tosfos says the following. Tosfos, the third Dibur Maschal on the page. L'gevina ika d'boi b'ne'atfei. Perush likaf chalav min ha'akum. Lasos kavina. The Mishnah only prohibits buying milk from a non-Jew to make cheese. Aval le'el gabe likach kavina shel akum, buying cheese from a non-Jew, which remember Rabbeinu Tam permitted, right? Rabbeinu Tam adopted the position that the only reason for the gzeir of the Mishnah was because of giloy, the milk left uncovered, and we're not makbid on giloy anymore. So Rabbeinu Tam and the Chachmei Narbona held that if you knew the rennet was kosher, you could buy cheese of a non-Jew. So when we said earlier, aval le'el gabe likach kavina shel akum, lek you don't have to be concerned that some of the milk wasn't kosher. Why? Kevan she'osa oso letzarko, because the guy made the cheese for himself. That would be shooting himself in the foot. Why would he want to do something that would make it harder for him to make the product that he's trying to sell? The guy, he wants to just sell you milk, so he'll adulterate the milk. He'll throw in some camel's milk. So, but if he wants to make cheese with it, so when he makes the cheese, he's not mixing in non-kosher milk when he makes the cheese. So now the only shaila is the cheese permitted or not? But if it's going to be prohibited, it's not going to be because of chalev tameh. And if it is permitted, in fact, if there was no gzeira on gvina sakum in a particular circumstance, you don't have to worry either that the cheese was made with non-kosher milk mixed in. It's only when he's selling the milk as is. Okay, later in the Gemara, I don't know where, but it's probably a little bit later, we're going to talk about the question of how much does the Jew have to see. The Mishnah said that chalav shechalavo akum ve'en yisrael ro'ehu. The guy milks the cow, but the Jew doesn't actually see him. So the Gemara is going to talk about doesn't see the milk the cow. So the question is, what if... Okay, there's only one exit from this room. So let's say the cow is in this room and the non-Jew is in this room, and I've already done like the Yichud room. I've checked it out, and there's nothing but an empty bucket, a cow, and a non-Jew here. Okay, that sounds like the beginning of a joke or something. A cow and all right. So anyway, so now I stand outside the doorway, and the guy comes and gives me a bucket of milk. So I know that's impossible. There is no way possible that could be anything but milk from a cow.
I
didn't see him do it. So the assumption halacha, and this will later serve as the basis for Moshe's leniency, is that that's permissible, right? As long as, in other words, if I'm sitting outside the corral, and in the corral are nothing but cows, and there's no way for the guy to get out, or even if there was a way, but all I have to do is stand up and I can see what he's doing, and he's afraid, you know, if he's supposed to be getting cow's milk, and he knows if I stand up, I'll see him milking the pig into one of the buckets, and he's going to get in trouble, so that's called mirtas. He's afraid, and therefore, there is no concern of chalav akum.
Okay. Mashgiach that has a key.
Right. So in other words, by milk, the concern is, by cheese, it's interesting because there's a machlokas about whether or not a Jew actually has to make the cheese. And the kashrus organizations try to be machmir, even though it's a big machlokas, the Shach and the Ramah, and a machlokas later, the Achronim, but I think most hold like the Ramah, who's not machmir, but nonetheless, the kashrus agencies try to have it with many of the cheeses where when Mashgiach presses the button to start the process. So not only is you know that the ingredients are kosher, the rennet's kosher, but it's actually being made by a Jew. But really, al pi din, that isn't required. But by chalav, everybody agrees. If you know it's kosher milk, then it's permissible. Because the way the Gemara will say is that even if the Jew doesn't see the milk, if the guy is afraid of getting caught, that creates enough of a chazaka, enough of an umdana, of an estimate, that you know the milk is kosher, and that's enough to do away with the gzeira on chalav akum. Then the Mishnah doesn't say, gvina sh'akum she'en yisrael ehu. And it just says there was some gzeira on gvina space unyaki without the Mishnah explaining any more details. Okay. So we'll eventually return to that issue. But now the Gemara gets to the question of pas. So what I'd like to do now is I'd like to just read through the Gemara once. We're not going to get further than that today, but I sort of want to set up the question. Because the Rishonim are going to struggle with a well-known practice that we have versus what the Gemara seems to say, but not clear what it says. V'hapas. Bread. Amar Rav Kahana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Pas lo hutra bebeistin. Rav Kahana quotes Rabbi Yochanan as saying that the gzeir of Pasakam was not undone by a beistin. Now, if I were to stop here, what would be the conclusion I would reach? So, first glance, I would say that pas is not permitted because lo hutra bebeistin. If, however, that is true, it's a very odd formulation of the statement. I should have said, I would have written, pas asur ha pas adayin lo hutra. Apas lo hutra. But it says lo hutra bebeisden. Now, normally the way you would have, what you would have needed to permit pas akum was another beisden, because a beisden, wherever it was, the Gemara will talk about which beisden. No, the next one will talk about, but probably Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel made a gzera against pas. Their beisden made that gzera. So, of course, you need another beisden to permit it. But why is the formulation lo hutra bebeisden? So now the Gemara says, michlal, from this we can infer, de'ika man de'shari. There are those who permit it. So, how do you see that? So, the simple reading of the Gemara would be that Rabbi Yochanan said, pas lo hutra bebeisden. The fact that Rabbi Yochanan needed to say that, when the Mishnah already says that it's prohibited, indicates that somebody else said otherwise. Somebody else said that pas was hutra bebeisden, or was hutra. So now, okay, so if the Gemara is going to acknowledge this, you'd expect them to quote who says that it's permissible. And now the Gemara says something very odd. In, yes, you're right. The Chiasa Rav Dimi, when Rav Dimi came from Eretz Yisrael, he told a story. Omar, Pam Achas Yatza Rebbe Lusada. One time, Rabbi Yudanasi went out to the boondocks. Vehevi Oved Kochavim Lefanav Pas Pornima Afesa. He brought in front of him this beautiful loaf of bread. It was a large loaf of bread, and Rashi says Pas Porni was like our ovens where you bake the bread, you put the stuff in on the side. Their ovens, you put it on the top, you stuck it to the walls of the oven, like a barrel-shaped oven, but the medieval ovens are already more akin to our ovens, you put stuff in from the side. He brought him this beautiful loaf of bread. Amar Rebbe, Kama Noah Paszo, how beautiful is this bread. Ma Ra'u Chachamim L'Osra. What did the Chachamim see? Why did they think it was a good idea to prohibit it? So the Gemara intervenes. It's not Rav Dimi talking. It's not part of the story. Maro Chachamim Mishum Chesnus. That's why they prohibited it, because of intermarriage. Ela Maro Chachamim La'osra Basoda. Okay, it means, why did the Chachamim prohibit it out in the middle of nowhere? Okay, when you're in Manhattan, there are plenty of opportunities to get past Yisrael. But if you're in, you know, Elmira, New York, so the odds are you're not going to find a Jew who's baking bread there that you could get access. So the Gemara says, "Ksvurin ha'am hitir Rebbe ha'pas." The people thought that Rebbe had just declared pas permissible. He thought the gzera doesn't apply or shouldn't apply, or he was declaring that it didn't apply. Basada. Velo, he says the sugya. Wrong. Not true. Rebbe lo hitir es hapas. No, he just said, nebuch, right? You walk by a bit, you know how many times you walk by, you know, the cart, you know, and you smell this really good, you know, whatever, meat cooking, and you say, sometimes you wish you could take a little vacation and enjoy it, right? Fine. So, sometimes it's schwer zu sein yet. So anyway, the Gemara then says, Rav Yosef v'tem Rav Shmuel bar Yehuda amar, no, lo kacha yemaisa. You got the story wrong. Ela Omru was as follows. Pam achas halach Rebbe lemachom echad. He went to a certain place. V'ra pastachok l'talmidim. He saw that the talmidim had trouble getting bread. And bread was the staple of their meals. Everything else was sort of an adornment to the bread, the parperisa pas, but pas was their meal. So Rebbe said, Amar Rebbe, ein kan paltar, there's no professional baker here. Kisruna am lomar paltar akum. They thought that Rebbe meant that pas palto, you could have a non-Jew, in other words, a commercial baker. V'hulo amar ela palto Yisrael. So Rebbe only was talking about a Jewish baker. He was wondering, there's so many people here to buy, why hasn't somebody opened up a business? Where's the entrepreneurial spirit? Is the entrepreneurial spirit gone from the Jewish people? Why is there no Jewish baker? That was what Rebbe said, but he didn't say it was permissible. Now if you tell this story as it is, so who's the man de shari who permitted? We have the people made a mistake. Rebbe never permitted. Now the Gemara continues. Amar Rabbi Chelbo. Rabbi Chelbo says, Afil leman de amar paltar akum. Even according to the one that Amar says, according to the one who says that it is permissible to purchase bread from a professional, from a baker, a non-Jewish baker, lo amaran el deleka paltar Yisrael, avamakom and ito paltar Yisrael lo. That's only if there's no Jewish bakery bread available, but if there is, you have to purchase from the Jewish bakery. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Afilu leman d'amar paltar oved kochavim, who said that you can purchase from a paltar oved kochavim, hani mili b'sada, avo be'ir lo mishum chasnus. It's only in the fields in the middle of nowhere. The way the Rishonim explain is that it's not as common you're in those circumstances, like you're traveling. So in those circumstances, we're not afraid of about the concern of chasnus. But you're in the ear. If you're in a settled place, so then you're not allowed to buy pas paltar of a goy. Okay. Now, there are a couple of... So the plot thickens. Firstly, where is the man da'amar? In other words, it sounds like the man da'amar, paltar of shalav ha'kochavim, sounds like the man da'amar, the one who says you can purchase non-Jewish bakery bread. Who said that? Nobody said that. Rebbe just said, Nebuch, they shouldn't have... If only they hadn't made the gzera. Or in one case he said... He was talking about Palto Yisrael. So who said it? That's entirely clear. That's question one. Question two is, assuming that one does accept that somebody permitted it, and assuming that we paskin that way, what are the conditions that are attached to it? In other words, one thing I think is very clear, and all the Rishonim pretty much say this. The Gzeir of Pas Akum still applies to a private individual's bread. Your non-Jewish neighbor who bakes a loaf of bread for you, even though you know that everything is kosher in it. In fact, as a general rule, I remember I asked Rav Schechter this question a long time ago. I actually asked him about pasta, plain pasta. Does it require hashgacha if they never put anything on kosher? And the answer is fundamentally no. And he said to me at the time, he said that the bakery bread, like the Italian bread, that in the supermarket people complained to the OU, how come they give a hashgacha, different hashgacha organizations give it, and they don't have the bag sealed. Right, you go into Acme or used to be Pathmark, and you can get the bread, and it'll have hashgacha on it, and the bread is not closed. How can they do that? The answer is because the bread doesn't require hashgacha, because the bread, if the bread was conceivably, if it was likely or probable, it would have been non-kosher ingredients in it. You would have to have the bag sealed up. You need at least chosam echad, but the fact is you don't, because that bread is assumed to be kosher. Your non-Jewish Italian neighbor makes this wonderful bread, and you know it's always kosher. It doesn't matter. It's still also because of pasachim. But coming from a bakery, that's the situation where there will be leniencies. And the question will be, how do these leniencies apply? In other words, if there's a non-Jewish bakery there, let's say you're in the boondocks, it happens to be a non-Jewish bakery for some reason. Can you only do it besadeh? Can you only do it if there's no Jewish bakery there? How do you combine these various factors? We'll have to talk about that as well. Okay, but still, the sugya requires a lot of explication, because who exactly permitted it? And the last line in the Gemara is, Aivu, who was one of the Talmidim, have a menakes for echel pasta be mitzri. He would be chomping on this bread if the Rishonim say it was pas balabatim. There was no kula here. It wasn't pas palter. So, Amar lehu rav avitemer nachmar yitzchak, lo tishtai mine de'ibu, de ka'ocha lachma darmai. You shouldn't quote, they said, not that you can't talk to him, you should not quote anything in the base medrash from him, because he's not nizer about pasakum. And out, which is kind of interesting, because if he was violating Yisad Rabbanan, they could have done better. They should have given him Malkus. Why did they say, don't quote any of his Divrei Torah in the base matters? Kind of strange thing to say. So we'll have to talk about what that means as well. But anyway, this is the opening salvo in the sugya of Pas Akum, and Be'ezus Hashem, next week to be continued.